Listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Mikey, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Saturday, Sunday, December 27th, 28th issue of the Wall Street Journal, review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And we'll start with the first article on the first page, How to Find More Joy, Success, and Connection in 2026. Our relationship columnist shares her favorite advice from readers so that you can start the new year on the right foot. This is timely, right? And this is written by Elizabeth Bernstein. I recently started to record my wins in a small notebook each day. If I hit a deadline, have a nice chat with a friend, make someone laugh, help my mom. It's a habit I picked up from a reader who wrote to explain how keeping track of daily accomplishments, no matter how small, may be even more empowering than practicing gratitude. The point is that it reminds us of our own agency, and even on our hardest days, we usually manage to rack up some scores. It turns out it works. And his email reminded me of one of my favorite parts of my job as a relationship columnist, hearing everyone's hard-earned advice on how we can improve our connections to others and boost our own well-being. All year, I chase the best advice from therapists, researchers, and regular people. And in December, I share the best of the best with you. Many of these life hacks are from older folks who know a thing or two about resilience. A few from previous years bear repeating. Marlene Critch, a 90-year-old retired hospital administrator from Burien, Washington, had been married for 50 years when she told me that her secret to marital success was for each spouse to give 75%. Which adds up to a total of 150 for the relationship. Don Nelson, an 89-year-old retired security company president, recommended that we maintain a mental F-blank-it bucket, where we can toss upsetting information that we can't change, such as the latest political mess or a beloved team's latest loss. Longtime reader Erwin Weinberg, 77, a retired consultant from Naples, Florida, shared a picture of the tattoo he got after his wife of 46 years died. It expressed his personal mantra, quality time left. Life isn't lived in a straight line, he said at the time. Quality time left helps me focus on what's important. Then there's this piece of sterling advice that I, let me turn the page, heard from my colleague Jason Gay, the Wall Street Journal sports columnist, that I practice almost every single day. Quote, you really should listen to more Stevie Wonder, unquote. Other tips are new to me this year, allowing me to share the bounty. Do the ring walk. When Brandon Mancini was in his 20s, he competed in an amateur boxing competition. That's where he learned how to block out all distractions and focus on his goal. Walking into the ring after months of training, he was hit by an assault of noise. The Rocky theme song blasted, and the crowd roared. His family and friends cheered, and His opponent's fan yelled obscenities at him. He ignored it all, stayed focused on his goal, and won the fight. Afterwards, when a local reporter asked him what it felt like to enter the ring, he replied, "You can't allow yourself to hear the noise. You have to go with a purpose." Since then, Mancine, a 48-year-old personal trainer from San Antonio, has used this ring walk mentality both professionally to build his business and coach his clients, as well as personally. First, he envisions the outcome he wants. Then he makes it happen. When he prepares for a date night with his wife, he pictures putting down his phone and focusing on listening to her talk and making her laugh. He takes a similar approach with his kids, setting work frustrations aside as he walks in the door each night. His goal, he says, is to end the evening with a proverbial arms in the air win. Life will throw so many freaking distractions at you, he says. You need to remove them and stay focused. Stay in the boat. Often when we're upset with a spouse or a loved one, our instinct is to argue heatedly or completely shut down. That's our fight or flight response at work, and it can cause a lot of problems in a relationship. Catherine Duncan, a 61-year-old minister from Minneapolis, learned a different approach from a therapist years ago. Choose the middle way. Instead of jumping out of the boat when a challenge arises, can you take a breath and stay present, she says. The goal is to keep from escalating the disagreement. First, breathe. It's okay if you need to take a short break, but explain this. Don't storm off. Then be curious. Ask yourself, what is really happening with this other person? Duncan says that she often uses this approach with her husband. When he was upset after a family gathering recently, she put her hand on her heart to calm down, created an energy boundary, and imaging a magical cloak around her that repels negative energy, and thought about why he was mad. This helped her stay calm and listen to her husband without reacting and making things worse. Staying in the boat diffuses the anger in the room, she says. You don't abandon yourself, and you don't abandon the other person. Write a poem. Tim Torkeldsen writes at least a dozen short poems a day that he sends to loved ones and strangers, including reporters whose work he follows. He calls them Tychus and Timorics. I've been receiving them for years. The 73-year-old retired clown started in fourth grade with a poem about his teacher. It wasn't flattering, but he got a kick out of saying what he thought. He wooed his wife with poems during their long-distance courtship in the early 1980s and still writes her a love poem every day. It must work because he's been married to her twice. He also uses poems to stay in touch with his 7 living children and 9 grandchildren. Torkeldsen of Woodbridge, Virginia, likes making people smile. He's worked for the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus, Disneyland, and McDonald's as Ronald himself, he says. He also enjoys the connection and conversation that his poems spark. But the real reason he writes poetry, he says, is simply to express himself. The trees are old bones, in winter, like me, swaying, wanting to be heard. That one popped up in my inbox. After our interview last week, quote, "Each poem I send out is a way for me to say, here I am. I hope you enjoy this little piece of me," he says. Strive for the high kick joy. Dolly Chug a professor at New York University's Stern School of Business, had an epiphany recently at a Radio City Rockettes show. As she watched the dancers march, twirl, and kick, she was struck by all the hard work that went into the production. What looked effortless and magical was carefully planned and practiced and earned, she said. Chug, 57, who lives in New York, says she used to expect joy to just appear in her life, like the sun. But her research topics include growth mindset, with practice, feedback, experimentation, and mistakes we can get better at something. She decided that she could have a growth mindset about joy, boosting its effect. She calls this concept high kick joy, and seeks out examples in her life, playing pickleball, building close friendships, having a dog, expensive, messy, disruptive, and delightful. I realized you can get better at joy, she said, and that it's worth the effort. That's quite an interesting article to start the new year. We'll go back to the front page and look at the second article that's on the front page, entitled, Is the West Over? As U.S. relations with Europe sour, longtime allies wonder if the world order will ever be the same. The Western alliance between the U.S. and its European partners has been a pillar of the global order since the end of World War II. Bonded by a common belief in freedom and democracy, it prevented major global conflict, defeated communism, and presided over a surge in global prosperity. Now, European leaders are asking whether it's dead. What we once called the normative West no longer exists, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz, the leader of Europe's most populous democracy, recently said at a gathering of business leaders in Berlin. Days later, the conservative and lifelong Atlanticist wistfully called on Germans to put aside nostalgia for an America they had known and loved for decades. The Americans are now pursuing their own interests very, very aggressively, he said, and Germany must do the same. A winter chill has settled on the transatlantic relationship, and many fear it might never recover, at least not fully. Merz and his European counterparts say they are waking up to a sobering realization. The U.S., at least under the current administration, no longer views Europe as its crucial partner in world affairs. The White House is increasingly hostile to the continent and regularly uses harsher language to describe European democracies than it does for traditional adversaries like Russia or China. Part of what's driving this shift, just a second while I turn to page 4, is a fundamental disagreement over what the West stands for and which side of the Atlantic is doing a better job defending its core values. Many in the Trump administration feel that Europe is betraying Western civilization by allowing immigration to dilute its historic roots as a largely white and Christian region. They also say European elites are driving a diversity agenda, in part by restricting free speech and political freedoms. European leaders disagree and point out that they regularly get stronger scores on democracy rankings nowadays than the U.S. They argue that underlying values should matter more than race or religion. They also worry that Washington is the one abandoning Western values by cozying up to land-grabbing autocrats and making territorial claims on allies such as Canada and Denmark. I'm just going to remind you, you're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. For the U.S., It isn't simply the Trump administration's words that have shocked Europe's political mainstream. It's that the rhetoric is backed up by action. Washington is energetically seeking a geopolitical accommodation with Moscow, partly in pursuit of lucrative business deals. President Trump's envoys are pressuring Ukraine to agree to a string of territorial and other concessions that most European capitals fear could destabilize the region by emboldening Russia rather than punishing it for invading a sovereign neighbor. For the U.S. to drop its alliance with Europe and side with Russia, with Putin the aggressor, just as Russia threatens us with war, that represents a fundamental break in the European-U.S. relationship, says Norbert Röttgen, a center-right German lawmaker and former head of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the German Parliament. French centrist politician Claude Malhuré told the French Senate, "Today, at best, Europe is alone. At worst, it faces two enemies, Russia and Trumpism." The broadsides against Europe began in February when Vice President J.D. Vance delivered a blistering attack on traditional allies, followed months later by tariffs on many European goods. But the past several weeks have turbocharged the sense of rupture. First came the 28-point peace plan for Ukraine, crafted by American and Russian negotiators, and seen in most European capitals as heavily tilted in Moscow's favor. Then, in early December, came the most recent edition of the U.S. National Security Strategy, NSS. A document periodically issued by the president setting out guidelines for American foreign policy. This one read to many Europeans as if the U.S. were filing for divorce, lambasting the continent for democratic shortcomings and accusing its elected leaders of doubling down on immigration policies that could turn their populations into, quote, majority non-European, unquote. The unspoken implications of this, quote, civilization erasure, unquote, was that immigrants and their descendants can't become European and adopt Western values. The document wondered aloud whether such countries could remain, quote, reliable allies, unquote. The NSS codified Vance's rhetoric as official U.S. policy, declaring the European Union an enemy of national sovereignty and vowing to intervene in Europe's internal politics by promoting anti-immigration parties, many of which are more hostile to the EU than to Russia. It reads like a declaration of political war on the European Union, said Timothy Garton Ash, a British historian. The Western Alliance still has plenty of defenders in the U.S. A different president could bring another shift in tone, even if U.S. and European political priorities never again converge as closely as in the post-war decades. Many Europeans and Americans still share deep affinities from popular culture to fundamental political values, and recognize each other as bastions of democracy in a world where autocracies are once again rising. But somehow, something now feels broken. We'll never have that confidence again that the United States is on our side, said Garton Ash. The West as an idea. The definition of the West has been contested, debated, and revised over time, said Georgios Vaxouzakis, author of the book The West, The History of an Idea. Given generations of social change in both the U.S. and Europe, he said, one thing is clear. It's too late to say you have to be white and Christian to be Western. The book traces how the concept of the West was spread by 19th century French thinkers such as Auguste Comte, who espoused a society based on reason and saw Europe in contrast to the rising autocracy in the East, Russia. By the 20th century, the idea of Western civilization, the idea of, had taken hold in the U.S. which sought to distinguish itself from the old world. This shift helped bolster the case for U.S. intervention in Europe and in both world wars. Both the Cold War, the West became synonymous with the non-communist, quote, free world, and eventually with development and modernization. Nations everywhere could, quote, westernize, unquote, their way of life by embracing democratic constitutions, individualism, and consumerism. Immigrants and minorities in the U.S. and Europe who embraced Western values could apply them to their challenge unequal treatment. Many Europeans argue that the Trump administration is projecting America's internal culture wars onto European society based on conservative anxieties about fast-changing democracies and ethnic diversification. Quote, America was the new world, running away from the closed, culturally hegemonic societies of the old world. Now it feels betrayed by the fact that the old world is becoming more like America, said Ivan Kostev, a Bulgarian political thinker. But many Europeans also agree with some of Washington's criticism of the continent, especially when it comes to sluggish economic growth, excessive regulation, reliance on the U.S. for security, and a lack of immigration control that's fueling a voter backlash. Quote, Europeans need to take much bolder steps on everything from innovation to economic policy. If we remain dependent on the U.S. in terms of technology, markets, and security, we will become a vassal and constantly humiliated, says Jeremy Gallon, a former French diplomat. Behind the transatlantic tensions of the 2025 lie two major shifts in how the U.S. views the world. One is Europe's declining economic, military, and demographic weight compared with Asia. Starting with Barack Obama, recent U.S. presidents have talked about pivoting attention away from Europe to focus on China. The other is the Trump administration's disdain for multilateral institutions, whose rules it considers impediments to the pursuit of American interests. even though the U.S. played a lead role in establishing the UN, the WTO, and other organizations upholding transnational agreements, nor does Washington continue to proclaim the goal of spreading democracy and freeing the oppressed, except in Western Europe. This feels like the transatlantic relationship as a values-based relationship is on its deathbed, said Laurel Rapp, Chatham House Program Director for North America and a former Deputy Director of the State Department who helped put together the previous NSS under the Biden administration. It made U.S. relationships with European democracies the anchors of its global approach. Europe must now negotiate a whole new bargain with the U.S., Rapp said. Quote, it can't be a values-based alliance on democracy and human rights. The direction of travel is commerce, deals, deregulation. In other words, what does the U.S. get very materially from Europe? A trusted ally with a question mark. The past year has sowed doubt in many Europeans' minds about the strength of the U.S. commitment to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the bedrock of European security for 75 years. If Russia imposes its will on Ukraine, rearms and makes an incursion into Estonia or Lithuania in a few years' time, will the U.S. go to war for a small European ally and uphold Article 5 of NATO's mutual defense treaty? A recent dinner with a former American diplomat, a senior British naval officer, said he no longer believed the answer is an unqualified yes, and that for the first time in his career, he no longer trusts the U.S. Andrew Roberts, a conservative British historian, said alienating allies poses longer-term risks for the U.S., an advantage America has long enjoyed over Russia and China, has been its web of allies who trust it to do the right thing, including standing up to dictators, he said. This new transactional approach sees the cost of everything and the value of nothing, he said. They see national greatness entirely through the lens of dollars and not the lens through which America has long been viewed as a beacon of hope. Excuse me. American hostility to the EU and support for populist parties is gratifying to Moscow. Since World War II, Russia has wanted to get the U.S. out of Europe and then fragment Europe politically so it can project power without facing a unified adversity, says Sergei Radchenko, a Russian-born historian at Johns Hopkins University. There seems to be this strange meeting of minds between the Americans and Russians over what Europe should look like, he said. You have the U.S. and Russia effectively working hand in hand to undermine the project of European unity, a project the U.S. helped create, unquote. Roberts, the British historian, says the U.S. and Europe should weigh the costs of breaking up the West. Quote, I understand America is tired of the role of global policeman, he said, but I'm sure China will be more than happy to become the world's secret policeman. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. We've been reading for 30 minutes. Okay, let's go back and look at the front page and see. Okay, we've finished looking at front page things, and we'll finish the small article on page 5. Your brain ages in distinct stages. Uh-oh. Research shows. A new study reveals that our brains evolve in phases, starting at ages 9, 32, 66, and 83. The brain goes through 5 distinct stages between birth and death, a new study shows. Scientists identified the average ages 9, 32, 66, and 83 when the pattern of connections inside our brains shift. The adolescence phase, they discovered, lasts until age 32. The brain then enters a period of stability until early aging begins at 66. The study could help explain why brain-related conditions arise at ages and provide a better roadmap to understanding healthy aging. Maybe there is something going on that is changing within the brain structure, said Duncan Astle, a professor of neuroinformatics at the University of Cambridge and co-author of the study, published in November in the journal Nature Communications. The study's authors examined results from about 4,000 brain scans taken from people in the U.S. and U.K., ranging from a newborn baby to a nonagenarian. The scans helped show white matter, a fatty substance that insulates nerve fibers, connecting brain regions, so the researchers could see the physical connections that change over time. They also created a, quote, average brain, unquote, for each year of life, Astle said, and used machine learning to help pinpoint moments of significant change in the data. During the childhood period of development, from birth to age 9, the brain grows in size, but because we're born with excess wiring, it prunes connections that aren't used or as efficient, according to Tara Spires-Jones, director of the Center for Discovery Brain Science and professor at the University of Edinburgh, who wasn't involved in the research. During the adolescent stage, between 9 and 32, the brain's wiring becomes more efficient with rapid communication between and within regions. Neuroscientists hate it whenever you say to them, so, when is the brain mature? When is the brain adult? Astle said. The really neat thing about this analysis is that it says when that is. At 32, our brains entered the adult phase, a period of consistency that lasts until 66. This period aligns with a plateau in our intelligence and personality, researchers said, and the regions of the brain become more segregated. Early aging begins after the next turning point, between 66 and 83. Some brain regions form stronger groups, known as modules, but they are less connected to other modules. Past age 65 or so, there's brain shrinkage and decreases in the integrity of white matter that corresponds to, for many of us, though not all, a slight decline in some aspects of cognitive function, Spires-Jones said. Beyond 83, in the late aging phase, our brains increasingly rely on individual regions with a small number of highly used interregional pathways, said Alexa Mosley, a University of Cambridge neuroscientist and lead author of the research. There is a pattern between the five stages and certain conditions. Most autism diagnoses are made in young children, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Up to 75% of mental health conditions begin by a person's early 20s. Per the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, Alzheimer's disease typically manifests during what the researchers call the early aging phase. Cardiovascular health, social connectedness, and exercise are all associated with positive cognitive health outcomes, and it's possible they also play a role in the rewiring that happens later in life too, Astle said. There's probably still a lot of individual variation around when these changes happen, said Katya Rubia, professor of cognitive neuroscience at King's College London, who wasn't involved in the study. This doesn't mean we should all be starting to worry the moment we turn 83, she added. So, cardiovascular health, social connectedness, and exercise are all associated with positive cognitive health outcomes. Okay, that's a sobering article. Now let's see what we have. American nightlife has gone honky-tonk. From New York City to Chicago to Portland, bars are riding a country boom, drawing everyone from outlaw singers to finance bros for country yoke and line dancing. Okay. On a chilly February night in early October, a shoulder-to-shoulder crowd thronged around the stage at Lucinda's in Manhattan's East Village. It was the bar's weekly Country Yoke show. A four-piece band played while participants, from the startlingly talented to the tragically off-key, waited up to hours for the chance to belt out songs by Brooks and Dunn, The Chicks, and Luke Combs. A recent New York University grad named Kelsey McLennan sang Before He Cheats by Carrie Underwood, stomping across the stage in cherry red cowboy boots while the audience screamed along. Ashok Shoki Pai, a 56-year-old former party promoter turned country nightlife fixture, led the room through a rendition of Take Me Home, Country Roads. During an instrumental break, he yanked the MC on stage to two-step with him. A lot of people have it in their head that New York and country don't mix, but country's mainstream now, said Kelly Swindoll, creator and managing partner of Lucinda's, which bills itself as a honky-tonk and juke joint. Quote, everybody's getting into it, unquote. American nightlife has gone honky-tonk. From New York to Chicago to Portland, bars are hosting line dancing events and live music performances that draw patrons, from outlaw singers to finance bros, dressed in cowboy boots, Wranglers, and the occasional Stetson. These businesses are riding the wave of a country boom sweeping music, TV, and fashion with no sign of stopping. Last year, Noah Ozens decided to close his Kips Bay sports bar, Sucker Punch, and partner with Chris Rada to renovate the space, importing wood from Kentucky and taxidermy from Indiana. They teased the grand reopening with Instagram photos of Bella Hadid astride a horse and videos of influencer types mugging for the camera in 10-gallon hats. A couple other places in New York City do a country or western theme, but the difference between us and these other places is the authenticity of it, Austin said. When they reopened the space, it had become Common Country, a full-on honky-tonk club, complete with $22 well drinks, which Austin said contain a generous Texas pour, and Casamigos tequila bottle service. Its walls are decorated with American flags, deer mounts, and Western movie posters. A sign above the DJ booth reads, "Long live Cowboys." There are hay bales everywhere. In terms of business, the increase has been about 100%, said Rita, who also co-owns the popular meatpacking club Common Ground. Other venues are rebranding to meet the moment. Stolen Saddle in Chicago, a three-story, 16,000-square-foot behemoth on a busy strip near Wrigley Field, was, until recently, a tiki bar. Country has always been popular, but its tent has never been so big. Pop stars like Beyoncé, Sabrina Carpenter, and Chappell Roan have embraced the genre. Today's Nashville hitmakers collaborate with artists from the worlds of Christian music, Mexican regional, and rap. Morgan Wallen, the reigning king of commercial country, blends hip-hop, hard rock, and honky-tonk in his music. This expanded definition of the genre is on full display at Common Country. Stephanie Wagner, a Rockaways native who runs a website called Country Swag, runs the bar's music programming. She often books local DJs who specialize in the crossover between country and electronic dance music, popularly known as Yeedem, Y-E-E-D-M, pronounced to rhyme with Yeedem. We do bottle service, we do sparklers, people are dancing on tables, but it's country vocals over the beat, Wagner said. The proprietors of Desert Five Spot in Brooklyn, Williamsburg neighborhood also pride themselves on having an eclectic playlist. We have DJs who play everything from Dwight Yoakam to Bruce Springsteen and Merrill Haggard to Chappell Roan, said Chase Manhattan, regional director of entertainment at Desert Five Spot. The bar also plays Yeedem, he said, but it certainly doesn't define us. Known for its mechanical bull and the 4-foot-tall custom disco ball cowboy boots that loom over its dance floor, Desert Five Spot, which first opened in Hollywood in 2021, unveiled its Brooklyn outpost last year and has since expanded to D.C. with Miami on the way. As liquor sales decline nationwide, bar operators have had to get creative to combat tightened purse strings and an increasingly health-conscious public. The Showdown Saloon in Portland, Oregon, offers weekly country-western cabaret and burlesque shows on top of more standard-issue honky-tonk fare. We have the hipster country crowd, and we love them because they spend money, said owner Frank Falache. But we also want to draw from the suburbs and the rural areas and do the stuff that gets actual country folk into the city. Popular culture has long shaped New York's bar scene. In the 1970s and early 80s, the height of Texas chic, the Lone Star Cafe in Greenwich Village drew a voguish crowd of downtown types and hosted concerts by Willie Nelson and George Strait. The Lone Star Cafe was also famous for the 40-foot iguana that adorned its roof. Meanwhile, across the country, establishments that had previously been disco-oriented were rebranding as country discos to capitalize on the fervor sparked by Urban Cowboy and its soundtrack, the line dancing craze of the 1990s, spurred by Billy Ray Cyrus's ubiquitous Achy Breaky Heart video, brought its own wave of country out venues, which in turn stoked the demand for dance floor ready hits from stars like Shania Twain and Alan Jackson. More recently, New Yorkers seeking a honky-tonk experience have flocked to the divey Skinny Dennis in Williamsburg, which opened in 2013. This year, the venture expanded with a new location, five times the size of the original, in the heart of American honky-tonk, Nashville. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And it's 45 minutes after the hour. Some see the trend as part of a broader conservative vibe that accompanied President Trump's re-election. There is precedent for that. The urban cowboy fad of the 1980s dovetailed with the rise of Reaganism. Luke Timm, the doorman at Common Country, known to his TikTok following as Hot Bouncer, said his experience hasn't felt political. When I'm at the bar, it doesn't feel like, oh yeah, America. It just seems like we're all country music and we all like a Southern vibe, Timm, 27, said. Okay, now let's find out what else we've got here. Sorry to be rattling all these pages at you. He took leprosy patients in hand to end stigma. The physician scientist contributed to advances in understanding and treating the ailment, also known as Hansen's disease. Through much of the 20th century, Americans with leprosy were forced to live out their lives in isolation at the National Leprosarium, later called Willis W. Long's Hansen Disease Center in Louisiana, which initially functioned more like a maximum security prison. Patients who tried to escape were shackled to keep them from trying again. Leprosy, a bacterial infection known as Hansen's disease, has been curable by a combination of antibiotics since 1981, and the facility closed in 1999. But people with leprosy say the stigma endures. They find many still prefer to keep their distance, despite the fact that the disease isn't spread through casual contact, and 95% of people are naturally immune. Even doctors often suit up in masks, gloves, and other personal protective equipment to treat patients with leprosy. Dr. William Levis, one of the nation's leading specialists in leprosy, eschewed such protection. As head of the Hansen's Disease Clinic in New York's Bellevue Hospital for nearly 25 years, the dermatologist made a point of holding his patients' hands. It was his way of demonstrating that there was nothing for him or anyone to be afraid of, said Louis Balquin, a public health nurse at the outpatient clinic, one of 16 federally supported Hansen's clinics in the United States. Levis, who died November 14th at the age of 85, eased his patients' anxieties about spreading the disease or becoming disfigured by it. Leprosy, he told them, is one of the least contagious of all infectious diseases. He'd never caught it himself. Within a few days of starting the multi-drug treatment regimen, they wouldn't be contagious at all. Within 2 years, they would be cured. We see about 10 patients a week here, Levis said in 2024 video for the clinic. The good news is that we cure them all. A misunderstood disease. Levis helped dispel the myths and misunderstandings that fuel public fear of leprosy, said Jose Ramirez, Jr., who was diagnosed with the disease in 1968. Forced to leave his hometown of Laredo, Texas, Ramirez spent 7 years at the National Leprosarium. Dr. Levis was a special man, said Ramirez, now 77. He showed genuine concern for those of us who experienced Hansen's disease, as well as our families. In addition to treating patients and publishing scholarly articles about his research, Levis spoke at conferences, wrote opinion page pieces, and gave lectures in an effort to build awareness about leprosy among physicians, scientists, and the public. The disease is rare enough in the United States, with just over 200 new cases reported in each of the past 2 years, that it's not usually the first diagnosis to spring to a physician's mind. But early detection is critical, because while the sores and lesions caused by leprosy can be healed, complications from later stages of the disease, such as shortened fingers and toes, become irreversible even when the infection itself is cured. Specializing in leprosy as a clinician in the 1980s, Levis provided compassionate care for a disease few other practitioners wanted to touch. Historically, there has been so much myth and fear around leprosy, and healthcare access for patients has been limited, said Dr. Animesh Sinha, a dermatology professor at State University of New York at Buffalo. He was able to change the paradigm around leprosy treatment in this country, a passion for T cells. William Robert Levis was born November 28, 1938, in Milwaukee, the middle of three children. At the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he earned a Bachelor of Science and a medical degree, Levis became fascinated with T cells, the white blood cells that help defend the body from infections. Although he went on to study cancer developmental disabilities, and ultimately leprosy, the T cell remained at the heart of his scientific inquiries. He had two sons, Robert and William Levis, from his first marriage to Rita Kennedy in 1961. The marriage ended in divorce. In 1980, he married a microbiologist, Georgia Barnett, whom he met at the National Cancer Institute, where he was a senior investigator for the dermatology branch. They were both passionate about immunology, said Bob Levis, his brother. It was the key to their marriage. They always had something to talk about. Mostly it was T cells. The pair were married for 38 years and had one daughter, Laura Levis, who died in 2016. From an asthma attack at the age of 34. She had sought help at a Boston area emergency room, but found the entrance blocked and collapsed outside. In response to her preventable death, Massachusetts passed a 2021 law, Laura's Law, requiring hospitals to improve access to emergency rooms. Georgia Lewis died 2 years after Laura from cancer. Always on call. In his final years Levis was hospitalized repeatedly for seizures. He met his partner of the past 4 years, Angie Ramarine, in a rehabilitation facility as he was recovering from a major seizure, but he continued seeing patients at the Hansen's Disease Clinic up until the week of his death, apparently from a heart attack while he slept. "This is what he loved doing," said Ramarine. "He just wanted to heal people." Over the years, Lewis treated hundreds of patients with leprosy, but gave each one individual attention, according to Balquin, the public health nurse. He invited them to bring loved ones along to appointments so he could answer any questions they might have about the disease. He wrote notes for them to bring to work, assuring their employers they didn't pose a health risk, and he gave them his cell phone number so they could reach him anytime with concerns, which they did, sometimes for years after their first appointment. He always answered, Balquin said. Wow. There's a picture of this gentleman smiling, obviously in a hospital. He's got all the hospital gear and stuff around him. He looks like a nice man, like you'd expect from the article. Sorry to add that to this. Quite an article. Armandino Batali, 1937 to 2025. After leaving Boeing, he became the Prince of Pork. Once Armandino Batali retired, he had time to go back to school, intern, and start his business. Generation of his family members had been in the food industry. His grandfather, Angelo Merlino, founded a food importing business and grocery store in Seattle. His son, Mario, became a famous chef in New York. Even his father, Armando Batali, was in the industry his own way, running a feed business in central Washington state. Armando went in a different direction. Born in Seattle, October 11, 1937, and raised on a farm in Harrah, Washington, he studied chemistry at St. Martin University in Lacey, Washington, and spent 3 decades at Boeing, mostly in quality control, much of it in Europe. After he retired, he had an idea for getting into the family business. He studied at what is now the Culinary Education in New York, interned at Alp Salami in Queens, apprenticed with butchers in Tuscany. In 1999, he and his wife, Marilyn Batali, opened a hole-in-the-wall deli in Seattle called Salumi, specializing in sandwiches made with artisanal cured meats. Marilyn made gnocchi in the front window. In the back, Armandino cured soppressata, his salumi, salami, and much else. They were just around the corner from his grandfather's original storefront and short walk from Armando's first career. "What I did for Boeing applies to what I do here, quality control in food," he told the Seattle Times. Sit down near him and stories of Europe and favorite meats tumble up, unforced, with no need to impress, Seattle Weekly reported. Chat a while longer and your sandwich order may be augmented with little taste of dishes that come up in conversation. A chunk of pork cheek, a few slices of cotechio sausage. Salumi was sold out side family in 2017, but Batali, who died November 28th at the age of 88, continued cooking. For years, he could be found on Fridays cooking meals for those in need at Seattle's St. James Cathedral Kitchen. "Kindness and generosity was his calling card," said Howard Schultz, Starbucks' former chief executive. "I went to the shop as much to see him as I did for the best Italian sandwich lunch one can find anywhere in the world. You've been listening to a...
The following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision,